Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Lazy CEO Podcast. I'm Jay Liu. Join my conversations with the entrepreneurs behind the iconic brands we all know and love. I'm so excited about my next guest, Lisa Messenger, founder of Collective Hub. Being one of the OGs in the Sydney entrepreneurial community, I've known Lisa for quite a while now. Despite having no experience in media or magazine, and also despite print media being on a decline by this point, Lisa launched Collective Hub magazine in 2013, and it was wildly successful and physically distributed in over 37 countries, featuring the likes of Richard Branson and Jamie Oliver on the cover. Unfortunately, the business scaled too quickly and Lisa nearly lost everything. She had to sell two of her properties and sunk that money into a business as bridging finance, which was never to be seen again. This would be so devastating for anyone, but what Lisa did next shows true grit and resilience. She has since then bounced back and relaunched the brand, and it's now bigger, more profitable and sustainable than ever. Lisa is so authentic and transparent with sharing her experiences and learnings, not just in business, but also in her personal life. She's been through 16 rounds of failed IVF, but subsequently was given the ultimate gift of life from a friend through surrogacy. Lisa has now written 38 books and sold over 2.5 million copies. And oh my God, this woman is so impressive. So that's enough intro from me. Let's just get into it. Lisa.
Oh, we're off and running already.
Yeah, we're starting.
I love it. Hi.
Thanks so much for coming all the way from Byron.
That is no problem.
You've been in business for 23 years now?
23 years.
Oh my God. You've just always been so like authentic and transparent and candid with sharing everything. So I'm looking forward to this so much, and our listeners are going to love this. So where your journey started?
I started my first business 22nd of October 2001, and it was before anyone was talking about entrepreneurship, and I didn't know anyone else who had a small business. It was pretty alienating. So I was working for a company called Fit Sponsorship, and I was doing sponsorship for Cirque du Soleil and The Wiggles and Barry Humphries. It was really cool doing deals, like monetary deals between corporates to sponsor these different properties. And I loved it. And I was only there 8 months, but it really was foundational for so much of what I've gone on to do in my life. I was fired, but in the nicest possible way, because I had always said to my boss, Adam, I was always like, I want equity in the company, even though at the time I had no idea what that meant.
I was like,
you know, I wanted to do my own way. I was always trying to break the rules and do everything. And in the end, he just said to me, because I wasn't conforming to the systems and processes, he said, look, I think you should go out and do it on your own, which was honestly the best thing that ever happened to me. I had $4,000 to my name at the time, and I just jumped.
Wow. I think that's the thing. People don't understand there's no liquidity in equity. Equity doesn't mean anything until a liquidity event. I guess people want to have ownership in something, but
I was naive, and that was my ego talking, right? I was like, I wanted ownership of something. But yeah, exactly. It took me a lot of years to really understand what that actually meant.
Yeah. Or until other people ask you for it and you're like, oh.
Yeah.
And then you started an agency doing sponsorships after that?
I did a 6-week small business course, which in hindsight was really funny because I didn't know how I found it, but it was through the Eastern Suburbs Business Enterprise Center. And I remember this guy, David, and I was like, okay, that sounds like something I need to do because I have no idea about business. And I remember him saying to me, what's your Centrelink number? And I was like, what do you mean? Yeah. And he was like, oh, this course is for people who are on the dole or something. And I was like, nah, I don't have that. Anyway, somehow I was like, I'm not going on the dole. I'm good. And somehow he let me into this course and I did it for 6 weeks and then I just started. So I started ridiculously in hindsight as a sponsorship and marketing agency. I did that for the next 11 years, I would say. And a lot of small business owners will relate to this. I overserviced, undercharged, was everything to everyone, didn't have systems and processes in place, was largely swapping time for money. Not a clever way to run a business or scale a business. And there are so many lessons, but I was a really slow learner for the first 11 years.
Did you not value your own, the value that you were bringing? So you're undercharging, you're almost like paying for a job.
I think it was lack of education back then. And also it was really different. I mean, we're talking about 2001 till say 2012-ish. I mean, I started to get it together and I actually had a really, really profitable business about 3 years in.
That's so people had Hotmail addresses and there was no social media. There was a different time.
Yeah. I think about 2005, I probably started actually turning like a really good profit and it was a good business. I think what was different back then was there weren't great networking opportunities. I didn't have mentors. And because I think it was really long before we kind of started and, you know, what's available now, there weren't podcasts there, you know, there were books. I read Richard Branson's book and like all sorts of other things, but I didn't have the education and the ability to fast track myself through that. And it was only through conversations with other people. I remember sitting down with someone explaining my business model and they were like, oh, so you're basically consulting and that's your time for money. Like that is not scalable. And it was just little conversations like that that led me to kind of change the way that I did everything. A big turning point, which often happens in business, was a pain point. Always happens in business, actually, for me. Anything that's been amazing for me has come from a time of adversity or pain or seeing a problem. So in 2004, so 3 years after I started my business, I decided I was going to write a book. And that was a pretty lofty ambition because I'd never written anything at school. I did what was known as veggie English. I'm sure that would not be very politically correct these days, but it was for really stupid people who had no idea.
I hated English at school.
Yeah. So then I went through this whole personal kind of crisis. I was drinking too much and all sorts of stuff, which we've talked about before. And I was really unhappy at the core. I didn't really understand who I was or what my beliefs were or what my values were. And so I decided to go around Australia and interview people about what happiness meant to them. And I decided to turn it into a book. My entire knowledge of the publishing industry was a half-day self-publishing workshop and a half-day publishing workshop. But 2004, I put this book out called Happiness Is, and I looked at traditional publishing versus self-publishing. And I decided to do it myself because basically, it was speed to market. I lent on my sponsorship knowledge, which I've always done ever since. And how do you look outside an existing industry and bring those lessons in? And I decided if I can pre-sell this book like I would sell a sponsorship, then I can go much faster and much harder than just going through traditional bookstores. So that book sold 36,000 copies in the first 12 months. And a bestseller at the time, depending on who you talk to, was 5,000 copies.
Yeah, that's huge.
It happened because I thought differently. So I remember Officeworks bought 10,000 copies. I saw them doing like back in the day, their catalogs, it was like spend $200 with Officeworks and get a free yoga mat. And I was like, surely this book can happen. I cold called and I was like, hey, I've got this book on happiness. Like, can we do that? I didn't know about gift with purchase. So I didn't know anything about what it meant. And they contacted me and I looked at, okay, well, if that works, let's segment the market and go through who are the like-minded, non-competing businesses that could potentially buy this. So Mercedes I decided, why don't you buy a book to surprise and delight when people test drive? So they bought 2,000 copies. So wow. I did deals and deals and deals and deals and deals.
Because it's also like, but how do you think you got the deals across the line? Because like at that time, you don't have the personal brand that you have now.
I had nothing and I was nobody. I know for sure that so much in business is about story. Mm-hmm. And getting people to believe in us. That 8 months in my last job 23 years ago was so foundational for the way that I've continued to think and do business every single day. I always think, what's the value exchange? What's in it for you? What's in it for me? I just started thinking, and I literally do this all the time now. I go, okay, let's just go through the alphabet. Automotive, airlines, accommodation. And then I'll go within those industry segments, like what airlines are there? What accommodation? What automotive? And then I'll go, is there a fit with my brand?
Back then you had to think so much. Well, you still do have to think out of the box, but like,
well, this is
now
how
you
I
can
thought.
Go on Instagram and just like go on your feed and get ideas. But this is,
so there was no Instagram back then. So the Clinique deal I did, which, you know, is foundational as well. I was like, my thinking was, okay, they have a perfume called Happy Hearts. They're in Myer and David Jones and all the key retailers. I've got a book called Happiness. So I contacted them and said, hey, if people buy this perfume, can they have this gift with purchase? And what happened was, free advertising, they put big signs that point of sale in Myer and David Jones and everywhere else that they were stocked saying, buy Clinique perfume, Happy Hearts, get this copy of this book.
Wow.
So it just blew up. I'm literally talking 20 years ago. So way before influencers or any of this, which has become such an everyday part of our vernacular now.
Wow, that's huge. Was that kind of the start of like you having the confidence to be like publishing content?
It was the accidental start, right? It was because I was desperately unhappy at the start.
Did the book help you?
Yes. Yes, it did. Because that gave me a sense of purpose, right? Mm. It was, I went around Australia going, I'm so unhappy. I just want to find out.
What is happiness? Give me the TLDR of the book.
What generally happened was a few things. One was people would either say, oh, walking along the beach with my kids, like, which is beautiful, but very surface and I didn't dig much deeper. Or, and this happened quite a lot, when I asked people what's happiness to you, quite a lot of people burst into tears. And it challenged people because a lot of people were like, actually, I don't know, or actually, I'm in a marriage that's not working, or whatever it was. So it was a fascinating thing to do. And each and every one of the 38 books that I've now gone on to author in the last 20 years, the foundations are still the same. They're very much rooted in positive psychology and finding and, you know, self-exploration and seeking. And that's really become my life's purpose. But yes, did the book make me happy? Yes, it did. Because A, oftentimes we don't know how we're going to do something, but we just start. So I was like, I'm desperately unhappy. I want to go around Australia and find out what happiness means. By having those conversations and connecting with so many different people from so many different walks of life, it gave me this innate sense of happiness. And then because I accidentally created this publishing model, what happened was that gave me a huge sense of purpose and personal satisfaction because the book just blew up. And as a result, I accidentally, on purpose, found myself at the helm of a publishing business, publishing a marketing business that actually started to make sense. And I started publishing books for other people because people started coming to me saying, because before me in Australia, there was really only more or less the traditional avenue. Go to a traditional publisher, wait 18 months before they put the book out for you. It was something like 1 in 4,000 unsolicited manuscripts actually make it to a published book. Like the statistics were really dire. Most authors get like $1.30 a book. And so suddenly, because I'd had some success, all these people started coming to me and saying, can you publish my book? So I then went on to do a book for Toby's Estate Coffee. Just so many different people, Commonwealth Bank and lots of individuals and lots of brands. And I did all of Lorna Jane's books at the start. So it went on to be a pretty big and very profitable business.
How was Collective Hub born from this?
I published for other people from 2004 to 2010, 12. What happened with that was I got to know so many extraordinary creatives and entrepreneurs and intrapreneurs and different businesses. And what I realized was there were all these conversations going on behind closed doors. I'd be like, Jane, but what's your supply chain? Or how did you fund this? Mm. Or like, how did you connect? And I feel like a lot of the media at the time in 2012 weren't telling the story behind the story. So I was always left scratching my head going, but how, but why? How did Jane do this? What's the vision? What's the purpose? Trying to unpack everything in business. Mm. And so even though I'd been producing books then for a lot of individuals and corporates, it was quite one-dimensional for me. And also as an entrepreneur, like, it was very systemized then. It was like, come to me, I'll either get you a ghostwriter to work with you, I'll edit your book, proofread, design, fact check, go to print distribution. Like, it was a clever way to run a business. Mm. Finally, I had a great system and I was pumping through a couple of hundred books or whatever, however many we did over that time. But I needed a new challenge. Like, I was making great money, but I was comfortable and I was bored. In 2012, I remember walking into my office in Surry Hills and saying to my team, that's it, we're going to do a magazine. And it was so funny. So many people will relate to this. The day before, I was like, right, focus, this is what we're doing. And I don't know, I just had this like yearning and I was like, I'm so sick of this. I want to push myself. And the idea, because I knew print and I didn't really have an understanding of digital back then, is I was like, I want something where I put all of these amazing entrepreneurs and people that I know and I'm surrounded by into one format. So I came up with the idea for Collective Hub, Collective being better together and Hub like a centralized location. The crazy thing about that is it sounds simple when I had a lot of publishing experience, but a book is a very different beast to a physical magazine. And I'd never worked in media and I'd never worked in magazines before, but I had a really big vision. And in my first ever editor's letter, I wrote something like, I want this to be the most extraordinary magazine on the planet. I want it to, you know, support entrepreneurs. I want it to be raw, real, relatable, attainable. And I want to tell the story behind the story. And so I had this big vision. Then I needed to fund it. So going back to what I talked about initially, I pre-sold it to a whole lot of different corporates. For anyone in business listening to this, it's important, again, to think outside of the box. I decided that at the time, print magazines were selling flat ads on a page for 10 grand a pop, and they had a subscription model. No one had ever heard of me, really. I had a pretty low profile then, and I'd never worked in media or magazines. And this is 2013, and people said print then was dead or dying.
Yeah, it was dying at the time.
Dying at the time.
Like, the big ones were like closing. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
So the first issue of Collective Hub, which came out in February 2013, cost me 350 grand. And I had,
whoa.
Yeah, and I had money because by then I had a profitable business, but I didn't want to sink that money into it. It was going to be a long road and it never would have worked. If I went like traditional magazine publishers and tried to sell ads on a page at 10 grand a pop, I would have had to sell 35 ads just to break even.
Yeah.
And no one knew me. People said print was dead or dying.
Yeah.
I had no experience. So I had to think really differently. So I broke some massive ground in Australia and globally, actually. The first deal I did was for $200,000.
Wow.
And it was with Andy Luck, who was the CMO, Chief Marketing Officer at Commonwealth Bank at the time. But I'd never borrowed and still haven't ever borrowed money for my business. Commonwealth Bank gave me $200,000 as a sponsorship and advertising deal. So I pre-sold. And that really shocked, in the best possible way, I think, the media landscape in Australia, because that had never been done before. I thought about, what are my saleable, tangible assets? Like, what can I sell? And I help and mentor so many people through identifying this now and pre-selling. So I basically went, okay, I'm going to have a physical print magazine. This was 8 months out from launch when I did this deal. And I was like, okay, so I'll be able to do advertising for Commonwealth Bank. I'll be able to do editorial, advertorial. They'll be able to have physical copies of the magazine. I can come and do speaking gigs for them. I can write stuff for their website. So I packaged it up and I was like, for their $200,000 investment, I probably went, here's $400,000 worth of value. Mm-hmm. So I value stacked it. And then Andy sat there and went, okay, great. I do deals like that all the time. It's not an investment. It's my money. I never had to pay that back. So that's how I pre-funded a lot of that first issue. That magazine, which is pretty well documented now, within the first 18 months of launch, it was in 37 countries physically.
Wow. How did you get it into so many countries?
Fake it till you make it?
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I have a magazine. Who will I put on the first issue? And this is another really important lesson in business. Give people what they think they know. So I was like, even though it was essentially a business magazine, I thought I need it to look like a fashion magazine. Mm-hmm. I need it to sit alongside Madison and Marie Claire and Vogue and Vanity Fair. Mm-hmm. That was my comp titles. I need to make it look fashionable and I need to put like someone famous on the front. So I was like, right, who are the people that I know the best? And Lorna Jane, I'd already published her books and she was a good friend. So issue one had Lorna on the cover. Issue two, I went to school with Mia Friedman.
Oh.
Mia at the time was really anti-print mags, despite having had years in print. So I was like, well, that'll be controversial. So I put Mia on the second cover. And then the third cover, I knew Lane Beachley. So I put Lane and Kirk on the third cover.
Wow.
And then I ran out of famous friends. So I was like, well, this isn't a winning strategy. So what I did then, talking about the global distribution piece, was I thought differently again. And I thought, who are brands? And remember, this is 2013. So this is way before influencers or any of what's going on now. And Olli Lingard, the Danish jewelry brand, was advertising with me and I saw that they had Helena Christensen as their ambassador. So I contacted them because I was like, I can't get to any celebrities. Like no one knows me now. And I said, hey, can I have Helena Christensen on my fourth cover? And of course, for them, they're like, amazing. Yeah. I thought it was a great win. But of course, she was on my cover wearing, you know, all their jewelry. I then Googled, how would you distribute a magazine globally? And I found out there was a global distribution fair in Toronto in Canada. So I got my ass on a plane and I went there. And it was one of those fairs where every half an hour you have a meeting and you get to pitch. And you line up the meetings before.
Oh, I've done that on the other end. It's like speed dating. I've done it with fashion suppliers in Chinese. Yeah, oh my God.
So that. This is about believing in yourself and hustling. And I knew if I was going to do that, I needed some global celeb on the cover. Mm-hmm. And so I went over there with this issue in my hot little hands with Helena Christensen on the cover. I had 13 meetings while I was there in the half hour speed dating with 13 different global distributors, and I did 13 deals. Now that's really unusual.
Wow.
And the reason is this: they are seeing people all day who are publishers, who are like jaded, they've been in the industry forever, they rock up, they really don't care about their magazine, they're just like, here we are again. I turn up, I've put my own money behind this, I'm excited, I'm thinking the world is my oyster. So I arrive with passion and enthusiasm and story. And I sit down with all 13 and I tell them, this is what I'm doing and this is why I'm excited. And as a result, I did 13 different distribution deals. So that's how my global distribution started. And it was, just built over the next however many months. And within 18 months, we're in 37 physical countries. So it's pretty wild.
Anyone's listening, going into these like expos or anything, it's like, don't be intimidated by the big names because like you're there, you have something special to represent in yourself. So
yeah. And what I would say about that, and I'm really big on this, is look outside of your own industry for inspiration. The reason I had the confidence to do that in 2013, and remember I started my first business in 2001 and I'd always been relatively parochial. I'd always thought, oh no, I need to stay within Australia. Like, I'm not good enough to go offshore. I was part of EO, the Entrepreneurs Organization, mm-hmm. and I went to a conference a couple of years before in Amsterdam. And I met a guy called Phil who had an umbrella company. So this has got nothing to do with magazines. But I remember just having a conversation with him about, oh, wow, how are you distributed in so many countries? And he had said to me, oh, I went to a fair, I found these distributors. That conversation with a guy who owned an umbrella company in Amsterdam.
Oh, physically umbrella. I thought you meant like, like a parent umbrella company.
No, a physical umbrella. So it's these little threads or jump points. And I feel like, you know, now when I write books, I go into the cooking section or the kids section, or I look completely outside of the pub. I never, ever, ever look ever in the genre of a book I'm writing, or when I'm investing in businesses as I do now, or creating businesses, I never, ever look within my own industry. Mm-hmm. I'm always looking beyond and taking inspiration from all sorts of other places.
Yeah, absolutely. For content inspo, I always look in other industries. I feel like fashion's almost like the product is right there. There's a lot of like beauty and like other kind of products that like they have to be so much more creative. They also have lower SKUs, like lower, yes. Like we've got new arrivals every week. So there's always something to talk about. But people who have like just that, like a few products that are quite like static, they have to get so creative. What were your biggest hurdles in those days to get everything up and running?
Many things, I think, and I wrote an entire book called Daring and Disruptive. And I think I know the reason I've written so many books now is when I created the magazine to be raw and real and, you know, lift the hood on everything and tell the story behind the story, I was like, well, if I'm asking this of other people, then I need to chart the journey. So that's why I've written so many books, because for the last 10 years, I've written in real time about anything that's going on. So for anyone who reads my books, I talk about all the finances, what was difficult, how I overcame things, how I entered a highly saturated industry. The hurdles back then were cash flow, always, for any business owner, I think. Entering a highly saturated market. So at the time, there were about 5,000 print mags already in Australia alone. So saturated market, which also is like a brilliant place to enter because there's already market education. And if you just do it better,
you're just stealing market share. You're not training the market, educating the market.
Yeah, I get very excited when anyone comes to me who wants to enter a pre-existing market, because if you can do it better, then, you know, you've already got it sitting there. It's much easier than cutting your teeth on something that doesn't yet exist. Me being an unknown at the time, getting people to believe in me was really tricky as well. And so I think this is where I'd spent years working on myself and seeking, from spending time in the Osho Meditation Center in India in purple robes all day to crawling nude through sweat lodges in Costa Rica. You name it, I've done it in the name of personal development. So I think by 2013, I was ready. And I had a really strong sense of who I was. And I mean, before Andy Lack at CommBank said yes, I would have made at least, I think, 80 phone calls where people literally laughed me out the door, like, who are you? Ridiculous. Prince dead or dying. We've never heard of you. You know, what credibility do you have? So it was tough, but I just had a really strong belief. And I think it's important in business to know when to stop and when to keep going. And I kept going. And, you know, that was really the pinnacle for everything that has happened since. We don't know what we don't know. So the next difficult point was 2017. So 16 years into my business life, I nearly lost everything. 2013 to 2017, I had Sarah Jessica Parker on my cover. I had Ryan Gosling.
Richard Branson.
I've shared a stage Jamie with Oliver. Richard. Yeah, all of these people. But I scaled really fast. And I went from literally in 2012, a staff of three, to a really big global brand.
How many people did you have on the team at that point?
We had 36 full-time in our Sydney office in Surry Hills in a pretty short period of time. But then I had a massive freelance team globally. And then we had like all of our different distributors. And like it was a big business. I'm a great founder. I'm not a great CEO. So, and I think it's
what
really,
do you mean by that?
I think it's really important to understand what you are. So suddenly I was at the helm of, you know, we'd gone from a couple of million dollar turnover to tens of million, and it was a substantial jump. I hadn't run a business of that size before, and I'm brilliant at being a creative, seeing things that don't yet exist, leadership, visionary, doing deals, as we've talked about, like love a deal, love kind of finding collaborative partners and, you know, channel partners. And I love seeking out a deal and creating. I'm pretty horrible at IT, HR, legal, finance,
accounting.
Yeah. And systems and processes. I was flying fast and the brand was building and building and building. And we had three very distinct pillars. We had the print mag, and then I started creating books and diaries and things. So printed products. Then we had a pretty large digital footprint. So we were doing 8 stories a day, well before ChatGPT, paying people $500 a story.
Yeah.
Crazy when you think about it. And then we had a large event footprint. So we were doing up to 4 events a week as well. So I wanted to be able to take people off the page in the magazine. Yeah. So it was a pretty sizable business. And then we were in 37 different countries, and that looked like, you know, newsstand and a lot of different partners and deals. I didn't have the right data orientated detail people beside me to say, stop running so fast and you're hemorrhaging cash. And we were hemorrhaging cash. And it's interesting when you start out, I feel like, I don't remember what the minimum wage was back then, like 40 grand a year or something. So like my 3 staff were, you know, on minimum wage. Yeah. They all loved it. It was the time when I had to literally say, go home at 7 o'clock at night, because they were so passionate about it. And then suddenly, you know, we started hiring people. Some of them were on, you know, 250 grand a year. And I just didn't have the right
And
people.
They probably delivered the least value.
They did. And I remember at hire number 17, the culture changed.
Mine was 12, 13, 14.
Yeah. And I remember we got a bad egg. And I remember
bad eggs, yes.
And they were suddenly like, everyone would take, I got to take my 1 hour lunch break, and like, I'm leaving, it's 5 o'clock.
I get one half an hour time in lieu. It's like, oh my God.
And that's fine, and that's legal, and that's whatever it is. But also the culture changed, because the people who were all there for the passion and the ride.
Yes.
Suddenly they started going, oh, but yeah, it changed. And as a founder who's creative, I found that most of my days were spent putting out fires, reacting instead of being proactive, and being basically an HR manager. So that was where, and I used to turn up every single day. I never forget, end of 2017, my CFO, chief financial officer, the worldie, would say, oh, we need another 100 grand. And I was like, what? And so then I was like, I feel like I was personally dialing for dollars just to keep the doors open.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't sustainable. So I ended up in 2018 closing the print mag. And it was really excruciating, because the brand was at an all-time high. Like from the outside in, from a consumer perspective and our community, it was flying. Like it was, I've never been part of something that was so big and so loved by so many people. And so I had to make the courageous decision to break the very thing that I'd started. And I made a video with my editor at the time, Amy, and I dropped it the next day, and then did this big cover with just a black and white letter on the front. Like, I broke more rules. What happened as a result was, I was really scared when I released that. I was like, oh God, are people going to think I'm a failure? Am I letting down this whole community? Whilst I own this brand financially, the community really owns it. But when I did that, the outpouring of love was just so extraordinary. I think because I owned it and I owned my mistakes and I said where we were at. Afterwards, Jules Stavana and like so many people started to say, oh, actually our brands aren't great.
So many people can relate to it.
Yeah.
So I do remember there's like another very well-known Australian founder who also closed their business down and said, oh, I creatively, my heart's not in it anymore.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why would you, if that's not true. This is the moment that people have been believing in your brand. This is not the time to back away and just say, I've had a creative change of heart. Because I also know like the actual story as well. For me personally, that was so impactful.
Yeah.
The way you handle that.
Thank you. I feel like having the courage to start it and then having the courage to break it, I gave a lot of other people permission in a lot of different ways. And I think so often, sometimes we have to break things in order to remake them. And so I did that. And it was really pretty excruciatingly hard at the time, but I have built back in a much more sustainable way with a lot more longevity. And my business now looks very, very, very different.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
To back then.
Hey Polly fam, I've got something special for you. For a limited time only, I have a discount code for my business course. In case you didn't know, the course is a blueprint for starting an online business and growing it to 7 or 8 figures. It's 10 modules of videos that you can watch at your own pace, covering everything from sourcing product, growing and developing your product range, operations, and marketing and scaling your business. Just use the code PODCAST at checkout at thelazyceo.com. Take me back to like the moment you realized you did have to close the print magazine down. Like, how did you bounce back from that?
It was pretty excruciating. It took me about 18 months to decide to close it down. Like there were a lot of signs. I mean, it is only me to blame at the end of the day because I scaled too quickly and the print was great. The digital, to be honest, I didn't understand the intricacies enough of it. And we were putting a lot of money into that. And I think as a founder, whilst we don't need to understand, we do need to understand the base level and have a vague understanding of something in order for it to work. And I just think I took my eye off the ball and trusted a lot of people. Only I'm to blame. I would come to work at my penthouse office in Surrey Hills every day and I'd bounce in and you got to keep the energy high for your team and your employees. And every day I'd be like, okay, let's go. And you know, this is great. And da, da, da. And as I said, from the outside in, it looked like the brand was, and it was for the most part doing really, really well, certainly from a brand and an impact perspective, which is really important. But underneath, we were hemorrhaging cash. And so I'd get to the end of the day and I'd go home and I'd like collapse on the bathroom floor and just cry and cry and cry. And then, you know, like on high rotation, I'd turn up the next day and be like, here we go, let's go, guys. And it was really hard because I had a lot of big corporates who would literally say to me, oh my God, your, you know, Collective Hub is the reason that, you know, I get out of bed every day and it's impacted all of our staff. But then, so I'd have all this positive reinforcement and messaging from the marketplace. But then I'd say to them, like, I'd have,
show me the money.
Yeah, exactly. And I'd have really honest conversations and say, hey, without your support, and like I had a whole lot of different things to offer, like not just, as I said, straight advertising. I mean, our model was always holistic and integrated. It was an ecosystem. It was like, you know, pay us some money for, and you'll get, you know, event sponsorship or ticketing, or you'll get copies of the magazine, or you'll get advertising or advertorial, editorial, or, you know, I can come and do a speaking gig. Like I had a whole plethora of things that we were selling against. So it was really difficult when I had these people on one hand saying, your magazine is everything. And then on the other hand, show me the money. It's like, and there was no money.
You know, we'd all be sad if Wikipedia went down, but how many people have donated to Wikipedia?
Yeah.
It's like, you've got to put your money where your mouth is.
And that was the tricky thing. And so my final edition was an open letter on the cover. And as I said, all previous covers had, you know, Ryan Gosling, Sarah Jessica Parker, like a lot of big celebs. I mean, everyone wanted to be on our cover. It was phenomenal. And then I said to my art director, I just want a black and white cover and I'm just going to write this letter because I wanted it to be shock value and I wanted it to be a statement for other entrepreneurs that if you don't support us, if you love our brands, but you don't support us, then we're going to close our doors. That actually makes me quite emotional because you and I both see, I mean, there are some amazing brands out there that become love marks and we evangelize, yet suddenly they disappear from the face of the earth. And it is because, like me, they didn't have the right systems and processes. They scaled too quickly. People didn't support them to the degree they needed. And these brands disappear. And so I think support small business. You know, if you love a brand, support it because you never quite know what's going on behind the scenes and how much people really rely on us.
And that's the thing. It's like people are the people that can make your business, but they're the ones that can ruin it as well. Like if you don't trust people, then you also can't scale because you can't work on the business rather than in the business. Oh. But if you trust the wrong people, you can be just thrown down the wrong direction completely. Yeah. And I've been there before. I can completely relate to that.
Yeah.
You bet your house on it as well. You mortgaged your house.
Yeah. I was fortunate when I had the publishing business that was really profitable when I was doing books for other people. I bought 4 properties in very quick succession. The banks were much more lenient than they are in 2024. And I kept buying properties and then leveraging the equity and buying again against those properties. So I bought 4 properties in quick succession, wrote a book called Property Investing the Australian Way because I always use myself as a human guinea pig, learn, then write a book about it. And in 2018, I sold 2 of my properties. I had one in Bondi at the time and one in Birch Grove. And it's kind of like surreal because I remember just going, well, I love this business. I'll do anything to keep it afloat.
Yeah.
So I sold the one in Bondi, and then I sold the one in Birch Grove. I pulled out about 1.3 mil in profit from those sales, put it straight into the business as bridging finance, or so I thought, never to be seen again. But a lot of people have said to me, how do you make peace with that? And I'm like, it's fine. You know, like it has to be fine because I see people in life who choose to take on a victim mentality. And if I let myself sit in that space of how much I lost or, you know, what I sacrificed, as we all do in business or life, then that would debilitate me. So I just kind of went, oh, well, that was an expensive MBA. an expensive learning curve. I know how to make money, right? So I thought, don't focus on that. Focus on using the experiences of what I learned about scaling, about the importance of being intimate with my data and my numbers, of the importance of systems and processes and having the right people around me, and use all of that steep learning curve to propel me forward. And so that's what I've chosen to do. Things come and go, you know, there is so much that is beyond our control. And what we can only control is our mindset and how we choose to reframe and move on. And that's how I choose to spend my life, really.
I love that. You saying like, I'm a great founder, I'm not a great CEO. It's like the 3 common themes from what you're saying about is like being what a great founder is, like your ability to think outside the box and to problem solve and figure it out and take a completely different path and approach to a problem.
Yeah.
Your ability to like have this conviction to enter this market, take that risk, go into a declining saturated market and just like go guns blazing into it. And now to bounce back from something like that, I admire you so much for it. It's amazing.
Well, I bounced in a different way. And so now my team looks completely different.
Yeah, I love this. So last time Lisa and I, maybe 2 times ago, last time we probably just us caught up.
Yes.
You told me that like everyone that works for you is are freelancers. You're essentially a digital nomad and your business is bigger and more profitable and more sustainable than ever. Like, that's so cool. Tell me. You already told me. Tell us this.
2018, when I close the magazine, I also decided to close my physical bricks and mortar office. And that was a really tough decision. Like after 17 years of having a physical office and always thinking about my team, if I can't see you, you know, are you actually working? And so this is pre-COVID, right? So I decided I'm going to close the office. I'm going to make everyone freelance. And what was interesting about that was that so many people still to this day who work for me had always been contractors. So Kate, my bookkeeper, has been with me, I think this year, for 15 years. So of that 36 staff, she was never a full-time staff member and she's been with me 15 years. Kevin, my IT guy, I think we worked out, has been with me something like 13 years this year. He was never a full-timer of those 36 people. So a lot of my core team, when I wound it back, I was like, oh my gosh, they've actually been with me so long and they never have actually worked in the office. That gave me the confidence. Also, Amy, who was the editor of the magazine at the time, had said to me, can I go traveling around South America for 4 months? This is like maybe 2017. And can I produce the magazine from over there? And at the time I was like, are you on crack? And then I was like, okay, well, she's got a pretty stringent KPI. Like she has to deliver me a print magazine at the end of every month. So, okay. And it worked really well. And when she got back to Australia, she was like, I want to move to Kiama on the South Coast. Can I do that? So like, although I had 36 people sitting in the office, I was like, hang on a minute. 2018, we changed everything. I had to make people redundant for the first time in 17 years, which was pretty awful. A lot of those people came back to work for me as freelancers or contractors. And I changed the way I measure everything. So everything became about output rather than time in office and bums on seats. And I wrote a book called Work From Wherever, of course, because I was like, I'm going to step into this, write a book about it.
Yeah.
And then COVID happened.
Oh my God.
People were asking me everywhere to come and speak on like, how are you embracing this culture? I became a global ambassador for HP and I was talking to like, wow. I opened the HP global conference. So like talking about, you know, decentralization and working from anywhere.
What a perfect alignment.
So it was like my kind of disastrous 2017, 2018 turned into me becoming an accidental authority on working from wherever and decentralizing, which of course now, you know, so many people do. I know here at Shopo, you have 2 days a week people coming to the office. So my entire team now, I only have one full-time staff member, Greta, who's essentially my PA slash, you know, marketing person.
Oh, whoop, whoop, to the PAs.
Yeah, ooh, ooh, to the PAs. And then every single other person is freelance or contract. But it means that I'm now lean and nimble and I can really pivot as I need to. And I think in this economy, look at how much everything is changing. I mean, look at AI and ChatGPT and it scares, like it's both amazing for a creative and really scary because I look at so many of my team, you know, be they writers or designers, I'm like, or, you know, photographers, like all of that could largely be replaced fairly quickly. It's an interesting time.
Yeah. And so what's next for you?
So at the moment, the business looks like, I'm going to say have been producing 40 to 70 print products a year. We lived in the US in 2022 and got the physical products into 40 states over there. But what's next may shock some people because for 20 years, I've been producing all of my own product. I love writing and I love the creative process, but it's time for another pivot because what I found is I'm at the helm of a really big logistics and inventory business, which you can relate to. And I freaking hate it. I cannot stand. I mean, we've got warehouses in the US and we've got three in Australia. We've got one in New Zealand. It's like so much product that we are moving around the globe. You know, we produce most of it in China. Like our supply chain and our logistics is massive. I freaking hate all of it and I really despise it. I mean, I have a great team who works on all of that and just keeps me abreast of the top level stuff. I've just made a decision. You heard it here first. I'm going to actually, God, I can't even believe I'm saying this after all these years. I'm going to steer my products through a traditional publishing system because I want to keep writing and creating, but I actually don't want to keep doing the logistics. And
I love that.
That came about accidentally because Sarah, my surrogate who carried my son,
yes,
Hugo,
I would have gotten to the personal stuff afterwards.
She and I have just finished writing a book. We have just submitted on Friday 60,000 words to a traditional publisher. And I fought that and fought that and fought that. And the reason we went with a traditional publisher was, and this is where silver linings, right? I was like, no, of course I'm going to do it myself. Yeah. Like I know how to
and
do it like that.
And it's such a personal one as well, yeah.
Yeah. Coming up with an idea to a landed product takes me 4 months to have something on shelf.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, depending on the complexity of writing a book. And then I was like, you know, and then I've got such a big distribution chain that I can just plug into and I know how to make it work. But Sarah and my relationship and my son Hugo are the most important things. And so I didn't want to blur the lines commercially and it would have been complex. So we decided to go the traditional publisher for the first time ever because I just wanted to go, let's come at this equally. Let's both write it and then let's hand over all the commercials to someone else. It's actually really nice. It's hard because I'm so controlling. I'm like, but what about the design and what's the PR campaign and how are we doing the rollout? Actually, let's see how it goes, but it feels kind of nice to like hand that all over to someone else for the first time in 20 years.
Yeah.
I'm always going to be involved in business. Always. So I'm like, from a creative standpoint, I just want to remove the logistics and distribution of that business and go into a much more digital business. So I'm now going to be doing a lot more mentoring retreats, developing some stuff in AI and having a play That's again.
Cool. I think it's a constant pivot because there's been different areas of what we do that's just gone in-house agency and just depending on like, you know, the phase that we're in. So it constantly evolves and that's what business is.
Yeah.
Let's shift gears into your rounds of IVF.
So I did 16 rounds of IVF and then Sarah, my surrogate, did another 2 rounds and then she carried my baby Hugo. So it was actually 18 rounds in total.
It must be at a time when I can imagine, you know, you're winning at life and then to have this one thing that you're able to make so much change and to have this thing that you just cannot control.
Yeah, really frustrating for an A-type personality entrepreneur who I feel like our greatest gift is asking, but why, but how, and then like just finding different routes, you know, that's what we do as entrepreneurs. I'm always backing the system and I see solutions where other people see problems. And for the most part, you know, I can put together a team and I can solve problems, but really frustrating when it's your own body that's not allowing you to create a child. But in the end, I treated the pregnancy like a problem to solve. And in the end, I found a solution. But it looked a bit like this. In 2015, with my previous partner, I got pregnant and then I had a miscarriage. Then we broke up. 2016, I went to Bali and on my birthday, I was like, I don't want to do anything for me today. I want to go and help other people. So I went to an orphanage, the Jodie O'Shea Orphanage, and there's this little baby Gracie that was lying on a mattress and she was 5 months old. And I ended up spending 3 days with her there and I tried to adopt her. And so I've been through many iterations and that was impossible as it turns out. And the red tape, you know, someone so desperate like I was for a child so desperately needing a home couldn't happen. I then wasn't with a partner, but being a, you know, I'm going to do this on my own kind of girl, I did 2 rounds of IVF with a sperm donor, which was an interesting process. It's like shopping for a baby daddy. that didn't work. I then met Stephen and we tried naturally for a while. We've been together 7 years. Then we did another 14 rounds of IVF together.
Wow, that takes such a big toll on your body.
Takes a big toll.
And emotionally, of
emotionally,
course.
Physically and financially. Emotionally because... because I was flying all over the world doing speaking gigs at the time.
Oh, wow.
And you got to
inject.
Yeah. So I had a letter, like, and I had to like carry needles and the meds around in an ice pack. And then I would have to like show a letter to customs and stuff, being like, I'm carrying needles. And I remember one time I had to fly to New Zealand for a speaking gig in Auckland, fly back, and I co-chaired the Virgin Way conference with Richard Branson. That afternoon, I flew to Noosa and spent the weekend with him on Make Peace Island. So I flew international. I was in 3 flights in 24 hours, international, Sydney, and then interstate, all the while carrying around my injections and having to inject myself. And like, it's no wonder it didn't work. But like, it was really hectic, right? Because I didn't tell anyone. Like, and I share pretty much everything in my life in real time. And until round 16, I never shared for 7 years. I never shared openly that I was going through IVF. Mm-hmm. So I was jumping on and off stages, running a business, injecting myself for 2 weeks after you do the implantation. So put the embryo in, you can't really do any exercise. And one of the greatest things for me in business and life is I train every day, because I feel like for my mindset, that just keeps me going. And mm-hmm. so then that was stripped away for 2 weeks every time for 16 rounds. Like, wow. It was a lot. And then financially, we've invested over $1 million to have a baby. You know, I don't take that lightly, because I know that I'm in a very privileged position to be able to do that. And I know there's a lot of people struggling with infertility who can't do that. I remember Stephen said to me when I was having a financial, physical and emotional meltdown, I was like, God, why? Like, why? All of your 20s, you're told, you know, wear a condom, don't root around. And I'm like, and here we are, like, you know, what I would do just to get pregnant. And he said to me, if this is our goal, same as business, I guess, you know, if we spend $1 or $1 million, you know, then, and whatever we have to sacrifice, we did sell our house in Sydney to, you know, fund it. People could say, well, lucky you, you could do it. But also I've worked my freaking ass off for 23 years in my own business. And I was fortunate that, you know, I'd made some money and we were in a position that we could do this. Didn't help when the economy kind of shut itself around the same time, and our retail sales went down 73% in 2022 post-COVID at one point. And I was like, okay, this is great. We're trying to like pay for IVF and like the market's kind of shut itself. So this happens and we just bounce through it again.
And how did the surrogacy happen?
Sarah and I met in 2011. I was writing a book, Property Investing the Australian Way, after I'd invested in properties, and I needed an editor, and I found this woman, Sarah, who was the editor of one of the property magazines at the time, and she was coming to have a meeting with me in my office in Surry Hills, and she emailed me saying, oh, I've got my 6-month-old baby with me and the babysitter's fallen through. Do you want me to postpone? And I was like, no, I love babies. Come in and meet with me. So she brought her then 6-month-old Lila into that meeting. That was the first time we met. Sarah went on to edit a lot of my books over years. And in 2018, when I was partway into my IVF journey, Sarah said to me, if you ever want a surrogate, I'd like be open to carrying your baby. And wow. I was like, wow, yeah. March 2022, I was living between LA and Byron, and I was in Byron or Bangalore, where our house is at the time, and the floods in the Northern Rivers happened. And so I ended up setting up like a drop point for all of the evacuation centers in the area and became a bit of a point person on the media, like helping to coordinate a lot of the flood relief. And Sarah's husband, David, is a radio DJ on the Gold Coast. I'd never met him. And he, unbeknownst to me, did this interview with me, like, and I was talking about the floods. And she texted me after and said, oh, hey, you were just on the radio with my hubby, David. And I was like, oh, cool. Didn't know it was your hubby. And she's like, how's the IVF going? This is on text message. And I was like, not great. Still want to be a surrogate. And she was like, yeah, love to. Like,
oh my God. So
it happened on a text message. Now I have Hugo, who's now 7 months old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was the most incredible journey. And I actually can't imagine having a baby another way now. Like, it was like having a baby with like your best girlfriend. She's played a way bigger part than Stephen has. Sorry, Stephen.
Yeah.
I'm sure everyone thinks we're lesbians, and I would happily be with her because it's been the most amazing journey to go through. Yeah.
What are the things that you do to keep yourself centered and focused?
I try and train in some way, shape, or form every day. Mm. And that is as much for my mindset as it is for like looking hot or feeling. And then things like my gratitude journal, I'll try and, you know, fill that out each day. A lot of the products that I've produced are because they're things that I would want to use. So then I produce them. So I've got products that I can use. So they're the main things. I mean, I try and meditate.
I'm taking so much of your time.
You're going to have to turn this into like,
I know.
True.
Do you have your two truth and one lie?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, bring it.
Okay, so in 2014, I was invited to go to New York by Anna Wintour. I had an email that landed in my inbox one day that just said from the office of Anna Wintour, and Anna invited me to go and meet with her in New York. Another one is in 2019, in one of five times that I shared the stage with Richard Branson, just before we were about to go on stage, we both said we were busting to go to the toilet. So we ran into the toilet at the same time and did a whizzer beside each other in the cubicles, and we could hear the MC saying, "Lisa Messenger, Richard Branson, get on stage now." And we're in the toilet cubicles doing simultaneous wheeze. And the other one is in 2022, when we were living in LA, we went to Santa Barbara for a day, and I was in a little old antique store, and I felt, and this was a really surreal moment, I felt a tap on my shoulder, and I turn around and this person goes, "Are you Lisa Messenger? I've read so many of your books. My team have had them sitting on my desk. I can't believe I'm meeting you." And it was Oprah.
Okay, so I know that you have met Anna Wintour. She did invite and fly you over, so I know that one's true. I hope you're not trying to get me with the date. Park that as true. Richard Branson, I know you've been on stage with him five times. How many toilet incidents can you possibly have?
There's been a few toilet incidents with Richard Branson.
And Oprah, okay. Do you think it's Oprah? Caitlin, what do you think? Okay, oh, okay. The simultaneous P, false.
Sadly, the Oprah is false.
I was going to go Oprah. I won't blame you, but I was going to go because I'm like, I feel like I know that one if that was true.
But a few things did happen.
That is amazing.
No, the simultaneous P did actually occur.
That's awesome.
Which is pretty wild, yeah.
So we're going to wrap it up with, can you please give our listeners your advice for anyone who wants to follow a similar path to you? Advice to your younger self.
My path is so checkered. I think allow yourself to have as many experiences as you possibly can. I feel like my path is not linear at all, but, you know, things that have taught me, it's only looking back, I can kind of go, oh yeah, that made sense. You know, like my first job was teaching horse riding and mucking out stables at like 4 a.m. But I'm like, that has nothing to do with what I do now, except I guess it taught me to get in and get my hands dirty and be grounded. You know, so I think try lots of different things. People often say to me, how do you come up with inspiration? And I say, just be counterintuitive every day. Like if it's just walking a different way to work or going to a different coffee shop or eating a different type of food or having a conversation with someone that you wouldn't normally or listening to a podcast in a different genre, like just keep pushing yourself a little bit every day outside of your comfort zone. And that's where I find the magic is. So I would say just be unafraid to try lots of things, you know, lots of hobbies, lots of interesting conversations. And I feel like that's how you really find what your purpose is and what lights you up and what you want to do. And then like just follow the little threads, follow the breadcrumbs, and eventually you'll end up finding out what it is that truly lights your soul on fire.
Mm, and you can really surprise yourself.
Yeah.
Love that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So much. Yay. Okay, that's it from me for now. Thanks for listening. And if you're loving the podcast, don't forget to leave us a review. And if you want more, join the conversation on the podcast Instagram at thelazyceo_podcast. Link to the show notes. Catch you next Tuesday.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.